Accession number 29079, Reel 5.
Larry Gaines, Reel 5. Was there any question of you staying on in the army?
No. I could have stayed on for another 6 months because the army was getting back to peacetime, so-called operations, and it had been tradition that the battalion based in Agra would provide the protective company up at Simla during the hot season. And my colonel said, I was then a captain in the company commander in the 1st Ulster. And because I was an ex-Chindit, and he'd been in the Chindits too, I was sort of looked upon favourably, as it were. And he said to me, would I like to take my company up to Simla to do guard duties there? And I could have the temporary rank of major. But I said no, because I'd got fed up really with the army then, and I wanted to get back to the London School of Economics. I decided that I ought to really finish my degree studies. So whether in fact I could have stayed on in the army after that or not, I don't know. But I was put out.
Could you explain the demobilisation process?
It was quite simple. My demob number came up, and so I left Agra with my tin trunk and pretty well nothing else, and made my way down to Bombay, and I stayed in some transit camp, I can't remember, for a couple of days, and then was on a troop ship coming home.
And when you got back, how did...
Oh, it was rather funny, yes. Everybody on my ship was to be sent to one demob centre, and we landed at Southampton, and I was made officer in charge of the train taking everybody on board, and we were going up to York. But when we got to York, they couldn't take us there, so we had to come back in another train. I think we landed up at Reading, where we were all given the usual treatment of a suit, a hat, and a voucher to your hometown. That was the standard procedure. Everybody went through it.
And was that then the first time you'd seen your family since...
Yes.
...departed to Africa?
Yes, they'd had it rough because they had... two houses away that had been hit by a bomb, and further up the road a flying bomb had hit, so the house was not in very good state, but it was standing, and my family was safe.
How did you find the country compared to what it had been when you left it?
Oh. Well, obviously, it was very run down and things were tight. The first winter was that dreadful winter of 1947, when there was snow and ice in January, I think, and it was so cold it lasted right the way through to April. So things were obviously very miserable. I found life at LSE a bit difficult because there were lots of young people there, but also a number of old sweats like myself. And I think we didn't get on very well with the younger people, but anyway, wasn't worried about that. But life was not that good. Not used to going back to civilian rations, particularly after our post-Chindit days in India, when there was plenty of food and Indian gin and whiskey around.
And what about the physical and mental impact of the war on you?
Oh, I don't think it had any real impact. I just thank my lucky stars, because during my service I had had shingles, a dislocated shoulder, a fractured femur, I'd had dysentery, bush typhus and jaundice. And when I was, before I left India, I was given a medical to check what class medically I should be put into for discharge. And I was made class A. They found nothing wrong with me. And it was so strange, because I went to, whilst I was on my DMOB leave, I went to join my sister in Ilfracombe. And one day, a policeman came to the door and said, "Is there a Captain Gaines here?" "Oh, I've got a message. You're to report to the military hospital at Millbank." And I went up there, and there was a board with a lot of senior medical officers, and they said, "We've been examining your medical history during the war, and it's impossible for somebody to have had all the things you have and still be grade A. We want to reassess you, because if we do so, you might be entitled to a pension." So I stayed there for 24 hours, at the end of which they said, "Oh, you are grade A, you are very fit. Thank you very much." So I didn't get a pension.
How do you feel now? How do you view the war now?
Oh, I've really forgotten all about it. My main interest now is that I am a member of the Chindits Old Comrades Association, and we meet twice a year. We're still, believe it or not, 400 strong. There are still 400 members, not only about 50 are active, because the youngest Chindit is now 85. So we're all very old. And we have an annual reunion at Walsall. That's where our headquarters are. And then at the end of October, we have another reunion. It's a kind of secondary one down in Exeter. And this is for people who can't, in that part of the country, who can't get to the Walsall one. So I go to both of them. The Chindits, I didn't mention the name, was adopted by Wingate, because it's from the Chinthay, which is the mythical lion which sits outside every Burmese temple. And that's how the Chindit sign originated. And so that's how it became called the Chindits. The first association was set up in 1947. By somebody up in the northwest of England, based in Liverpool. Oh, because one of the original Chindit units in the first operation was the King's Liverpool Regiment. I joined that, and I'd lost touch because after I'd got my degree, I joined the ICI for a year, and then by chance was met a bloke who turned out to be the chief accountant of the Iraq Petroleum Company, and he offered me a job because of my qualification in economics and statistics. So I joined the finance department of that company and spent the next 21 years in the Middle East. During that time, I'd lost touch with the Chindits, and it was only by chance towards the end of that time, or much later, in fact, that one of my old colleagues, Chindit colleagues, who I met on leave, said to me, "Why aren't you coming to the Chindit reunions?" And I said, "I didn't know there was anything had happened." And it seems that there had been all the various individual Chindit associations had come together to form the Chindit's Old Comrades Association. And so for about 15 years, I didn't know anything. But after that, I've been going regularly. Yes, I started off in, when was this, 1949, and the Iraq Petroleum Company was in operation before the war. They had built a pipeline from Kirkuk in the north of Iraq to Tripoli in the Lebanon and to Haifa in what was to become Israel. Because of the troubles with the formation of Israel, the pipeline to Haifa never worked, and the company decided that there was enough oil up in the Kirkuk field to warrant a building of a new pipeline, a 30-inch pipeline, and that was what Tripoli, the company moved its headquarters from Haifa to Tripoli, and that was the main operation center for the building of this new pipeline. So I was there on budgetary control, and I spent 7 years there, during which time I met my wife, we got married, my two daughters were born there. Well, after 7 years came the inevitable transfer, and I was transferred to the other end of the pipeline up in Kirkuk, where there was a huge company operation also. There were about 500 Europeans up there, and 10,000, I think the local Iraq employee numbers was about 10,000. There were 30,000 employees all told in the company. After 7 years there, I was transferred to the main headquarters of the company, which had been set up in Baghdad, because not only was this operations in Kirkuk, there were opening up the fields in southern Iraq around Basra. So I became part of the headquarters outfit in Baghdad. Stayed there for 6 years until finally, when Saddam Hussein was beginning to throw his weight around, etc., things were getting tight for the company's operations. They'd taken over all the new proposed areas for development and just left the company to operate the existing facilities. And at the end of 1970, I was on leave, and news came through my work permit had been withdrawn, so I couldn't get back to Iraq. So I was back in Tripoli, where I'd been 20 odd years before. I stayed there for 6 months. Then news came through that the ambassador in Iraq had managed to get my work permit reinstalled. So I drove back to Tripoli from Baghdad. I'd already driven 3 times from England through the Middle East. Drove out to Baghdad, and within 4 days, news came through that the colonel in charge of this sort of thing said, having got rid of me once, he wasn't going to have me back there again, and that my work permit was withdrawn again. So I had to go drive all the way back to Tripoli. This was in 1970, and I drove back through Jordan and around Mafraq area, just north of Amman. There was this Palestine insurrection going on, and this was the time that they had hijacked 3 airliners. And I could see these airliners parked on the desert, and I had a very difficult time driving past all these militias with the guns and God knows what. And I was glad to get into Syria, stayed in the Lebanon for 3 months, sent down to Abu Dhabi to relieve somebody, and at the end of that I was offered retirement on full pension. So I took it. And then I spent, just to wind up, I spent 2 years in Algeria. I set myself up as a quasi-consultant in the oil world. I became an advisor to the director of a new refinery being set up at Arzew in Algeria. I left after 2 years, spent the next 5 years as an advisor to the director of the oil company in the French Congo, not the Belgian Congo, the French Congo, at a place called Pointe Noire. And after 5 years I left and never worked again.
Had you learned, or did you speak Arabic?
When I first joined the company, it was incumbent on everybody to learn Arabic. Now, when I got up into Kirkuk, I remember, I think it was 1958. I was there in 1956. In 1958 was the first of the revolutions, when the king got killed. We were there was a complete curfew, and every Britisher that was then accused of being a spy by these madmen, Kasim and his gang. And the general manager then said, nobody is now to speak Arabic. I had learned quite a lot and could hold a conversation, but from that time onwards, only official contact with the government, such as it was to be held in any form of Arabic. None of the staff could speak it, because it was liable to be misinterpreted, and that was the end of it.
And how were relations between the Europeans and the Iraqis throughout your time there?
Well, with the company personnel, they were always good, but things gradually got worse as Saddam took power. They were becoming more and more nationalistic, and anti-imperialist, and we were the imperialists. We were robbing the country of its wealth and that. And finally, everything was nationalized in 1972. That was when Saddam was then really in charge. So relations with individual Iraqis was all right, but with government, etc., it was always deteriorating. I, for a time, was the secretary of the Baghdad Golf Club. We operated inside the Baghdad racetrack. And towards the end of 1970, I was asked to hand over all the funds and documents of the golf club to the government. So that was wound up.
And from your experience, from your time there, how do you view the current situation and the...
Well, in Iraq? Oh, it's an absolute and utter disaster. It's one of the things which the company had done from quite an early stage. The policy was to train Iraqis to gradually take over more and more senior positions. For example, in Kirkuk, they'd set up a training unit, and they had a big, in fact, a school was set up to train Iraqis in various ways, and those who had engineering talents were sent to England and elsewhere. And of course, gradually a nucleus of well-trained Iraqis was set up, and I'm quite certain that many of these people and their people, their children, etc., grew up to be part of the people who started to expand into the nuclear development. So the company, in a way, was responsible for the gradual better and better education of the Iraqis.
And how do you feel that the current situation will progress and evolve?
Chaos. Further chaos. I can't see any solution for it. The Kurds, particularly in the north, even when I was there, I mean, this is 40 years ago now, 36 years ago, were a pretty efficient as a group. And as we know, they've managed to sort of make themselves independent. I mean, I think what's going to happen, the country will split up into three. I think we've made a complete cock of it. We, the government, Blair and Bush.
Was that from the invasion from the outset, or do you think the aftermath was just mishandled?
I think it was mishandled from the beginning. It was now apparent, it's now becoming apparent, that after the Americans had managed to get hold of and defeat the Taliban and push them out of, defeat them in Afghanistan, It's now apparent that they moved into Iraq too quickly. There was no consolidation. So now we landed up with a terrible situation in Iraq, which they can't solve because they've lost control, and they're having a hell of a job re-establishing themselves in Afghanistan.
And was there evidence of the factional and regional differences when you were living there?
Say again.
When you were living in Iraq, was there the division between Sunni and Shia and the regional?
No. No apparent division. Everybody was living in fair harmony. Of course, there have been the odd troubles, etc., but that's normal. The Kurds have, of course, always been aiming to be fully independent ever since the last 100 years. So there's always been a free Kurdish down movement going on. I mean, they're still struggling in Turkey, and not so much in Syria, but they've completely established themselves as a semi-autonomous state in northern Iraq.